Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to episode 12 of Blue Jays Happy Hour. I'm Nick Ashbourne, joined as always by Andrew Stoughton. And I'm not going to forget to mention the guest early this time, so we will also be joined a little later by Kevin Goldstein of Fangraphs, a national writer for them, draft expert, and also the host of the podcast Chin Music, which you should definitely check out. With that out of the way, we are at this All-Star break, or we're coming out of the All-Star break. And we got to talk a little bit about Vladdy and the Vladdy All-Star Game experience. It's sort of the second time early in his career where he's made a splash there after the home run derby. Stoughton, what was the? I know you kind of wrote an extended piece on this. What was your impression of what Vladdy did and sort of how he made an impact in baseball in the bigger picture?
Yeah, he's just a fun guy, right? Like it's really nice to see it. I think I saw people, I think Gregor from the Star was, contrasting this Jays team with, say, the 2015 Jays team, which was not a particularly liked team around the sport. And it's nice to be in a different situation. That was fun, too, to have a team that was hated. But it just seems everybody likes these guys, and these guys are just... They like each other, and it's really fun to watch.
Yeah, like you mentioned, the 2015 team was sort of the us against the world type deal, which works really well when you've got one team in Canada, right? And the other teams are all in the U.S., so it's kind of like, oh, we're the ones that everyone's looking down on. It kind of plays into the international dynamics there. It was fun, for sure. But with this group, like, take the four guys who made the All-Star team, right? You got Vladdy, who's got kind of 100% approval rating, it seems, in terms of all the players and pretty much fans as well. Then you had Bichette, who had that kind of home field boost, considering what his dad has done at Coors. Yep. And then yep. Semien's got enormous sort of stature in the game, like one of the more well-respected guys. And Teoscar Hernandez is sort of that famous vibes guy. So you bring those four people together, and yeah. That's a pretty powerful group in terms of being ambassadors for the Blue Jays. And I don't know if the Blue Jays are going to become kind of the second favorite team of everybody, the way that, the Cubs used to be before they won the World Series or any of that. But the likability has got to be, 80th, 90th percentile around the league, especially if they go on to, beat the Yankees, beat the Red Sox, do something in the AL East where a lot of teams that are hated reside. I think there's a real possibility for them to gain some steam as, that second favorite team for a lot of baseball fans out there.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. And, how would you not like this team? And also, especially, like you say, if they knock off some of those hated AL East teams. It is, you would think that with four All-Stars, they would maybe have a better record. They're obviously, and we talk about it every week, there are obviously weaknesses on the Blue Jays still and things that they need to improve, which is sort of critical, I think, at this point, because I tweeted about this and I've written about it, and we've talked about it. Like, it's a really as much as we can think about it as like the first year of like their championship window kind of opening, it's also you only have Marcus Semien for so long. You only have Robbie Ray for so long, who is apparently the ace to end all aces at this point in his career. You really would hate to see them not capitalize on that and keep thinking too much long term, which is why it's going to be real interesting to see in the next couple of weeks, what they do trade deadline wise. Because the team is real good. It's real good and it's really fun, and it's sad to think of like the possibility that it could go the other way and have just sort of have all this momentum peter out and not have a great September, not have a great August, and I think we deserve better than that, and I think the team deserves better than that.
It is within the realm of possibility, though. I did a piece this week where I looked at teams that had kind of the similar playoff odds, and what did their GMs tend to do that made the playoffs, though. So kind of the hopeful teams in the sort of 30% right now, Blue Jays are 35. You could quibble with that number, but they're 4.5 games back of a wild card with a lot of teams in play. So they've got a lot of work to do. And generally in that position, general managers tend to make kind of those relatively small, like the Blue Jays of 2015, which were actually in a somewhat comparable position in terms of having that great run differential, having the great lineup, and not having the record, reflect that. That is the exception to the rule. It is great, and we all appreciate it. And I understand wanting something like that to happen again. But it is so different from what people generally do. People generally pick up a reliever. The 2018 Oakland Athletics were a good comparison for these Blue Jays, and they picked up, a starter in Fires. They picked up a reliever in Familia, who was a really good reliever at that time, and then they got Sean Kelly as well. Kind of another reliever. So they had a different shape of a team, because that was kind of one of those lineups with no holes as opposed to full of stars, which the Blue Jays are. but it was a similar result. Like, they were kind of an elite offense and position player group. And so I think that's kind of best case, but that's sort of the realistic good case of what happens here, is the Blue Jays get a really good reliever, a starter that is helpful to them, and another reliever. I don't see that huge overhaul happening.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't either. But that should be enough, really. They have lost so many tight games and so many games that were winnable, which is really my fear, is that we're going to look back at the season, when it comes to the end, and be like, man, just a couple of those games going the other way could have made a huge difference for them. But it also speaks to how, and this is what the team would say, this is their spin would be that, well, if we're in ball games, then we're good, which is not quite accurate.
It's accurate adjacent.
Yeah, exactly.
it is true. But the flip side of that, too, and I think that that's part of whether you're a fan or you're someone who is like a beat writer or an analyst about the team, when you see the whole season through just sort of one team's lens, it's easy to look at those games and say, oh, here's a lot of games that we could have won, but lost. But there's also those games that you could have lost but won, and you don't really consider those. Oh, those are just wins. You know what I mean? So like sometimes it's easy to get that mindset where it's like, oh, well, every time we barely lost, like that's a win that we should have had. But every time we barely won, well, that's a win. Now, the Blue Jays have this run differential that kind of proves, again, they are better than their record. This collection of talent is better than its record, and they do have that potential to go on a run. But it is easy to kind of look back and sort of pick out where wins could have been and kind of fool yourself into thinking maybe, because if you did that, if we really did that and we combed through all the games, like we went on Baseball Reference or whatever and we found, okay, here are the games and here's, especially if you want to be this guy, here's a Charlie Montoyo decision that he should have put in this pitcher, not this pitcher. And you really did that, you could find 12 wins. Like you could make the Blue Jays, this elite, elite team. You could find tons of wins and you could do that most seasons. So, I think there's a little, there's something to being cognizant of that. But at the same time, the run differential tells us this is a really good team. They didn't have Springer for the majority of the year. We know how good their lineup is when Springer is in it. And the regression candidates on this team in terms of doing worse in the second half is like Vladdy, obviously, and, Semien and some of the pitchers, I guess. But like, Robbie Ray, is he going to be worse in the second half? Like, I'm not sure. Like, it's pretty persuasive what he's doing right now.
It really is. Yeah. I mean, if he's not walking guys, then the stuff has always been there. Like, and that's really been the thing that's plagued him the whole time. I mean, keeping the ball in the ballpark is another issue, I guess. But yeah, it's been real impressive to see Robbie Ray, what he's been doing.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they laid out their rotation with Ray first coming out of the break, I know that doesn't mean that much, and maybe that gets you one extra start over the course of time, and we know that they like to give Ryu an extra day of rest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But If they were conceptualized Ryu as like the pure ace, the number one, as he was last year, they wouldn't have done that. They would have started with Ryu. Yeah.
I think that's true. And I think Ray, you know, likes to, you know, likes the routine, likes to be keep on his day, which I think is probably going to help him as well. But yeah, you're right. I think last year they definitely would have tried to get an extra start out of Ryu if they could have. And this year, obviously, has been less impressive for him.
I mean, again, you can nitpick these little things. Matt's at three, a little confusing to me. I would have taken either of the other guys.
Yeah.
I'm not quite as much of an alarmist about Matt's. I think some people are willing to say, oh, Matt's is a pumpkin, it's done. And I don't know if that's 100% true. Like, he still has pretty good stuff. Like, it seems to be a location problem, and those things can, they're not necessarily going to be fixed, but they are fixable. I don't know if he's an elite, you know, the guy he was at the first little bit of the season, that was never fair to say he was going to be that guy. But I guess we saw Ray doing it. So like, why not? Why not Mats? Why not everybody? You know, if someone can improve, everyone can improve. But
I think coming out of COVID too, like, you know, he had that time off and we haven't quite seen him at his best yet, but you know, if they're trading for a starter, I think he's going to take Mats' place in the rotation.
Yeah, right now, for sure. Now, again, you know, Stripling is a guy who could easily fall back a level. And I wouldn't be shocked if in 3 weeks he's the guy we're looking at. But, you know, the fact that Manoah's come up and his spot looks pretty safe. I mean, it was something early in the podcast we were kind of fantasizing about. We were like, oh, well, Manoah will be in the rotation. And we were almost joking about it. Like, oh, yeah, Manoah will be in the rotation and he'll lock down that spot later in the year. And that was sort of, I mean, is Manoah the best case scenario of what he could be? Maybe not, because the best thing was him just being too good at baseball to play the guys in AAA. But, you know, he's been, you know, he's really solid. And he's one of those things where you point to, okay, like, how are the Blue Jays going to be better in the second half than they were in the first half? And he's one of those guys because he can give them more volume because he wasn't up for the whole time. And he can maybe also improve because he's young and he's learning the major leagues. So he'd be one of those, like, okay, how are the Blue Jays going to create that internal improvement? Because if we agree they're not going to have this massive external haul, like, they are going to need some internal improvements. And he's one of those guys that can give them more in the second half than he gave them in the first.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree on that. And even his bad, like, his last start, he only went 3 2/3 or whatever, was still real impressive. Struck out 9 and you know, maybe needs to stop hitting guys. But
yeah, I mean, we joked about that again early in the podcast, you know, because it just seemed like a ridiculous thing. Like, oh, I mean, that isn't a thing that really surrounds. I can't think of any pitchers right now who are kind of like, oh, well, that guy's good. But what really holds him back is that he beans dudes. Like, that's just not like a profile. Like, we were talking to Kevin Goldstein later. Oh, behind the curtain, we already had that conversation. So we can't ask him about it. But I guarantee you, there's nobody on his like draft board that's like, oh, this guy is great. But what the problem is that he seems to bean people at inopportune moments. Like, there's no one in the draft like that. And yet Alek Manoah has somehow found that lane.
It's a wonderful thing, except, you know, the guy having to face him, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to do some kind of old school intimidation thing, like, oh, he makes people uncomfortable in the box. I'd be uncomfortable in the box against Alek Manoah.
Yeah, beefy as well. Yeah. I believe is what
extra large human, as you'll find out later. Before we get to Kevin, sort of the story of kind of literally the day, and this is changing all the time. So there's a, you know, on this podcast, we have a bit of a reputation of putting stuff out before news drops. I think this is going to happen again, but it's very possible, this one. But to be fair, we have to touch on that because this is sort of the biggest thing surrounding the Blue Jays right now is sort of when is this team coming home? And July 30th is the date where everyone would like to see it happen. And it has been a weirdly developing story. There's been a lot of vagaries. There's been a lot of talking about positive momentum without anything definite. And it has been odd for fans to see, you know, MLS go forward before, you know, nothing against TFC, but the Toronto Blue Jays are kind of objectively a bigger deal, I would say. And I don't know, there's probably someone who would take umbrage with that somehow. But I think that I could probably use television numbers or whatever the fuck you want to prove that the Blue Jays are a bigger deal than TFC. So, yeah, what is your thought process being kind of watching this whole thing drag out? Because it has seemed like it shouldn't be that hard as the province opens up. Like, if the decision is we're going to open up the province, you know, we're doing cinemas, we're doing indoor dining, and I know there are, you know, capacity limits on certain things, but that's the momentum. The momentum is people are getting vaccinated, cases are coming down. I believe Thursday there were 20 cases in Toronto as an example. Like, it's been falling precipitously as people are getting vaccinated. It's time to open Ontario up. What has made this so difficult?
Yeah, it's a great question, because the horse is kind of already out of the barn, right? Like, they had the FIBA tournament in Victoria. They had the Canadians hosted the Golden Knights. I don't know what the difference is. They're going ahead with the tennis. It's very easy to become cynical and look at the politics of it and who's donating to the which party and whatever, and maybe the Jays don't do that enough. I've had some snarky tweets about that myself. But that's only because we've been left in this place where we don't understand why some things are okay or exempt from the border restrictions and some things aren't. And it just seems like, I know TFC is leaving their unvaccinated players behind, and that's, I think that's how that's going forward. Baseball should have everybody vaccinated, like whichever moron clubs are not out there vaccinated, they should be at a competitive disadvantage, right? Like, it would be for, I would love to see the league using that and the government using that as a reason to get those people vaccinated by allowing or not allowing the unvaccinated people to come across the border. That's fine by me, but I don't think that's how it's going to have to work. I think we're going to have obviously an exemption for whichever weirdos on the Cubs or Mets or whatever don't want to be vaccinated, or the Yankees are and have had breakthrough cases. And the thing is, at this point, it's like, it's just, everything is sort of risky, right? You know, like, just existing in a world where there's a pandemic going on is risky. So, I think if you think about it in terms of like risk mitigation, it's way down the list of what will, cause public health problems at this point. So there's really no reason that they shouldn't be doing it. And, it gets harder and harder by the day to think that it's for any reason, that this delay is happening, but optics and politics as opposed to any actual like public health concerns.
Yeah. I mean, and we talked about those players have a modified quarantine who are unvaccinated, and there's a fucking hotel right above the ballpark
right there.
So yeah, you can get them there and they can just do that for 3 days. Like, it's not a big deal. Part of it, I'm inclined to think, is that, like, MLS, and to their credit, has just been, okay, we won't do the unvaccinated, then you can stay home. And it's harder to see that happening in baseball. And part of that is that, as a sport that we love, we don't like to talk about this aspect of it so much. But a lot of clubhouses and a lot of people around baseball are steeped in that right-wing American politics. Like, if you go to the average clubhouse and you talk to the American players and you were going to do an honest survey, like, you're going to find more Republicans than Democrats in there, to be honest. But, like, part of that is
people... Well, they're rich dudes from Florida and Texas.
Yeah, basically. Exactly.
Like, so that's what that is, yeah.
Yeah, and so as a result, I think that there would be there's people who are unvaccinated in MLB clubhouses for these kind of political reasons, and some of them are probably bigger names, and some of them are probably some of your favorite players. And I think in a soccer team, it's also a little bit more common to sort of move decent amount of your team in and out and cycle through them, and so missing a couple of players doesn't seem as, it always depends on the player. But in baseball, if you lose your 3 and 4 hitter, that's a little like, if that's, I don't think MLB wants to see that happen, where a game takes place in Toronto and suddenly, this team is missing their ace starter, and I think they absolutely should. And yeah, leave those people home, and then you don't have to worry about exemptions, and let's get this show on the road. I'd 100% support that, but it would create, it would shine a spotlight on some of the stuff that I think MLB would rather not have a spotlight shone.
I think, yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah, they don't want you to know which of your favorite players is a freak who doesn't want to get a vaccine.
Yeah, and like I said, it's a lot, and I'm sure a lot of them, you know, got a vaccine kind of anyway, and whatever, it seemed easier, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But like an 85% is a good threshold, like that's better than the general population. So I don't want to make it seem like, you know, clubhouses are just full of QAnon supporters and only one of the guys is vaccinated, because that's not necessarily the case. But there are quite a few people out there, and they're quite a few prominent people, and it just seems easier from the Blue, and you know, on the Blue Jays too. I'm not making this as if it's like
totally yeah.
So as a result, you don't need to highlight those people. But I'm curious to see what will happen, and I just don't follow MLS, but I'm curious to see what will happen as, you know, which players are unvaccinated are kind of spotlighted for fans to see, and for I wonder if how that's going to affect, you know, how the fan base perceives them and the PR and whatnot, because I can see that creating a little bit of a nightmare, because I know some players have sort of said whether they have or haven't, but it's not like there's been a survey that's been put out or anything, and not that there should be, because that's a little bit invasive, but
sure. No, but yeah, you're right. That is going to be very interesting to see how that plays out. And I don't know. Hopefully they just figure something out. It has been, you know, and I don't think this is even on the table. Like the idea of like having it become an incentive, like, oh, well, if you have to, you're going to be left home if we have a series with the Blue Jays in Canada. But those incentives have proven quite powerful. It turns out, you know, everywhere we look, or every day in the news, you'll see something where, you know, they're going to have a vaccine passport. You're going to have to, you're going to have a proof of vaccination to do indoor dining, to do all the things that are, you know, a return to normal. And it has driven vaccination rates up once jurisdictions have announced that. And yeah, anything to that end is good, because, you know, get vaccinated, you morons.
Like, yeah, for the fans, for the player, like, again, fans too. Yeah, I mean, I saw a case in France where they had cafes and indoor dining. They were gonna do that, like, you had to have proof of negative test and or vaccine, and then suddenly the next day they had the highest sign up rate in, like, right, the history of the pandemic, with like over a million people signing up. Because when you tell people, okay, cool, you can make your choice here, but that choice has consequences, suddenly yeah, that choice isn't as precious to them.
That's true.
So we'll see what happens here. It has been, yeah, it's been a bit of a slog. You know, we'd like to see baseball back in Toronto. We'd like to see it sooner than later. You know, if it comes back August 20th and it's just a stretch run and the Blue Jays are competitive, like, that's still going to be awesome. Like, I don't think that everyone should be immensely depressed if that's the outcome. It'll be stupid. It probably should have come July 30th. Yeah. But, like, at the end of the day, like, you know, it's a month, and hopefully you'll get to see, like, the stuff that you really want to see. But I know everyone wants to be at the ballpark. And, you know, maybe by the time this podcast, you're listening to it, you guys have a better idea than we do right now about how possible that is. So we're going to turn it over to Kevin Goldstein here. You know, between the two of us, our draft expertise is, I don't know, minimal might be a fair description of
it. That might be generous.
Could be generous. So when it comes to things like this, it's nice to talk to someone who knows what the fuck they're talking about. And Kevin absolutely fits that description. So listen up to what he has to say about the Blue Jays draft.
Hey everybody, I just want to take a moment to tell you about our friends over at Commons. Commons is a documentary podcast from Canada Land. Host Archie Mann takes you right into the country's dark underbelly, uncovering stories of crime, corruption, and all manner of misdeed. Previous seasons have delved into Canada's addiction to oil, the powerful dynasties that rule this country, and cops that kill with impunity. Brought to you by Canada Land, this podcast will make sure you never look at this country in the same way again. This season, Commons investigates Canada's current obsession, real estate. Real estate is by far our biggest industry, and often the only way in which Canadians can build any kind of wealth. And as the property mania of the last year has shown, People are willing to go to great lengths to get even a small piece of it. But our obsession with land is also the source of so many of our problems. From crime to corruption to segregation, Canada's history of real estate is dark indeed. Have a listen to the new season of Commons, Real Estate, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're joined by Kevin Goldstein of Fangraphs. I think that the question that our listeners want to know, and it's hard to say, whenever we're talking about the draft, we don't know how it went. But what's your impression of the Blue Jays draft? What do you feel about it today, even though however you feel might be totally wrong in, you know, 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Can I curse?
You can.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's all bullshit right now. I mean, it's our job to do, you know, to talk about the draft, and I'm going to report court a podcast in a couple hours where you kind of break down every team, and we're all going to give opinions and stuff, and like, we're all full of shit. Like, you're right. You don't really know if this is a good draft or not. Like, I'll come back on in 2026 and we'll talk about whether this was a good draft or not. But, you know, I understand people want to know. I thought it was an average draft for them. I think they did well in the first round. Like, I don't think they woke up expecting Hoagland to be there. You know, I heard his name throughout the picks ahead of him, really. I really heard he could have gone as high as maybe 12, and it seemed pretty clear he was going to go somewhere 15 to 18. And if it makes you guys feel any better, I was positive that he was going to go to the Yankees. That was his floor. Like, the Yankees wanted him to get to them, and he didn't. So, you know, maybe you can be happy about that. But it's a good first-round pick. I mean, you know, this is a guy who, if the elbow didn't go kablooey, would have been, you know, it's gone somewhere between maybe 7 and 10. And so, you know, to get that kind of talent at 19, I think is something you have to be really, really happy about. And I think teams are more comfortable than ever with these guys coming off of TJ, and they actually kind of like getting them and saying, hey, we get to manage the rehab instead of, you know, Ole Miss, you know, instead of a college program.
Right.
Like, you know, not that Ole Miss isn't a good program, it is, but like, they still don't have the resources that a professional baseball team has. And so, you know, this was already a polished guy. I don't think the year off is going to hurt him. And I also think the year off is not going to, I guess I would say, put him behind like it would in a quote unquote normal year. I think with, you know, with what we've seen in baseball with all of the injuries and a lot of that being kind of, you know, attributed with good reason to the bizarreness of 2020, I think you're going to see a lot of pitchers who got drafted, including by the Blue Jays, shut down. And so that's going to mean that it's not like other guys are accumulating innings and work that he's not. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of even reduces that. So, I mean, I think you got to be pretty happy with that. Like, their third rounder's an interesting guy. It's one of those dudes where, you know, it really depends on who you talk to. I talked to scouts who love this guy. I talked to scouts who were just like, I'm out. It requires dreaming. Like, I get it. He really, really looks the part. Ricky Tiedemann looks the part. This is what they should look like. But there was frustration with some scouts where, you know, this guy looks like he should dominate at a level like Golden West College is playing. And it didn't happen a whole lot, you know. And you walk away and you go, this guy looks really, really good, but he didn't really perform that well for his level. And, you know, it was kind of safe from there. It was just obviously, you know, as you guys know, it was a ton of pitching, a ton of college pitching and a lot of performers. I think Irv Carter in the fifth is a nice upside play and kind of a nice story. But, you know, I thought their draft was after I think Hoagland's a great get in the first. First is the important one. It's the overwhelming majority of your money. And after that, it was a little, I don't know, safe, I guess would be the word.
So you mentioned the amount of pitching. I think it was 15 out of 20, maybe 10 of the first 11. You maybe don't quote me on that. But it's in that range where it was, it was dominant. That was clearly the focus. And I heard you on Effectively Wild, and you were mentioning how the data to do with pitching is just a little bit more reliable in small samples. People are getting, you know, the pitch data off, you know, how does the slider move? What is the spin rate on the fastball? And those type of things, whereas they didn't get to look at a lot of at-bats for hitters. And then we saw the Angels had their, you know, the famous no-hitter, which will go down in history. Do you think teams are going to end up feeling good about that method, or is it something where in a couple of years there's going to be a bunch of position players that were drafted really low that people missed on they end up being really good because this was more of a risk-averse, let's go with what we know strategy.
I think there's definitely going to be some hitters that were not taken high who end up really good. And that can often be the case as it is. And as far as kind of, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, advanced evaluation, really breaking down data and video, the industry as a whole is way ahead on pitchers than it is on hitters, right? You can walk away and, put a pitcher in front of the lasers and you know exactly what his stuff looks like, right? Exactly what the velocity is, exactly what the spin is, exactly how much it moves. You can then measure that historically against other pitches that look just like that and get a good feel for exactly what this is. There is no data like that for hitters. People have all sorts of, advanced stuff measuring, bat speed and swing plane and all that stuff. But there's so many aspects to hitting that we can't measure with the lasers, and the biggest one is hand-eye coordination, which we might never be able to measure. And so I just felt like this year there was so much more of a comfort level. Like I feel like I know what this pitcher is, or at least I know what his stuff is. And I just don't have enough to go on with the position player. And I think it created a lot of trepidation. And I think the balance got, frankly, out of whack and just turned into pitcher for so many teams. Talk about the Angels, but, there are tons of teams who drafted, 15 or more pitchers. And it was a very strange, imbalanced draft in that sense. And I think it's solely because of the amount of data and the comfort level in what was a very uncomfortable draft because of the lack of really having a track record from 2020. And there was some problems with the college position player class this year. It wasn't a great one. And I think guys just kind of started leaning on the arms.
So you characterize the Blue Jays draft as safe. I think there's an idea in Toronto, they just kind of think of the Blue Jays front office as being a little bit risk averse. When you look at this draft and previous drafts, do you see a pattern there? Do you see a philosophy there? If you're going into a draft, are there guys and you can think, oh, that's the type of guy that a Toronto might like?
I don't think that's necessarily the case. I do think they are taking, in some ways, a bit of a more modern approach to some of these things. And I think this is something that the Yankees do as well. And I think it's a really good way to go. And the Blue Jays, I think, have followed suit in a lot of ways where it's to make a bad, investing analogy, it's kind of a portfolio diversification here where like their draft picks are their savings bonds and their international signings are their tech stocks, right? So that's, they get their safety in the draft and they get their high upside, high risk dudes on the international market. And, if you look at, think about the Blue Jays top prospects, it's a pretty diverse group. And there are a lot of really young players in this system, Martinez and Geraldo in terms of infielder. They've consistently been very aggressive in the international market with kind of these big tools up the middle players, and it's certainly paid off in a lot of ways, but they have a lot of really impressive international prospects. And so I think they kind of diversify that way where they go get their upside, they go get their flash, they go get their tools internationally, and they get, their guys who, that dude's just going to be a big leaguer, right? You feel comfortable about that. You get that in the draft.
One thing I thought was interesting about Hoglund in particular, but also just kind of scrolling through, and this is me reading descriptions, I don't know who the eighth round pick of the Blue Jays is, but I saw a lot of sort of 90 to 93 good command, and it seems to me that it used to be, and again, I've never been a draft expert, but I've always watched it. It seemed like in the past, people really targeted velocity because the idea was you can't really teach a guy to throw hard and we can teach him the rest of the stuff. And now it seems like there's an idea that you can kind of teach guys velocity. And I've heard with Hoglund, a lot of people say, okay, well, he doesn't throw hard now, but maybe coming out of Tommy John, you can rework and you can find some ticks. And then, then the stuff plays up even more and the command really comes into play. One, is that totally wrong? And secondly, what do you see happening with Hogan in that regard? And has that been a bit of a shift?
I mean, I think we live in a weird world where, Hoglund goes out there and kind of sits 92, 94 and bumps a few fives and we go, he doesn't throw hard. But I think it's really dangerous just to sit there and go, oh, we can make everyone throw harder. Are there players who have thrown harder? Absolutely. It's good to start with command, but you do need stuff too. And there are a lot of teams that did this. The Indians, if you look at their draft, a lot of college arms and a lot of guys who real strike throwers. And, the Dodgers kind of zagged when everyone zigged, and they took all these stuff dudes. They took all these guys who like do 98, 99 with vicious breaking balls, and sometimes they can't hit the broadside of a barn, and they're going to try to teach these guys command. And so like every team is different. I do think command is something that, you know, the great stuff wars, if you will, of the last 5 or 6 years, I think teams started to really kind of focus on velocity and spin and movement and stuff. And they draft these guys and you're like, that's great. He can't pitch, you know, and it's, you know, it doesn't mean it's garbage. It doesn't mean anything. Like there's dudes in the minors every day throwing who are like 98, 99, who are never going to get to the big leagues because they have no clue where it's going. And so you end up in this weird world that I do think we started to see a correction this year in terms of like, well, he's got to command it at some point. And it might have been a little bit of an overcorrection. And I don't think Hoagland's a good example of that, because Hoagland has a real fastball and a beautiful breaking ball, not to mention, go back to command. I think Hoagland's the command of his breaking ball is as good as anyone in the draft. It's absolutely gorgeous. But yeah, like dudes like Chad Dallas is a strike thrower. But I think, you know, we talk about guys who might gain something. I think you go back to the high school pick, which is Irv Carter, who's, you know, an interesting guy. Like you'd go see, you know, Andrew Painter at Calvary Christian, and, you know, who was a first round pick, and you'd stay an extra day because the next day Irv Carter was pitching. And like this big dude, you know, it's a high school kid. He's like 6'4", 220. And you'd see some mid-90s from him. And you, I think it's easy to say, like, I think we'll get this more consistently with kind of his maturity and development. I think that's fair. But I think it's tough to draft a, you know, a 21, 22-year-old guy and say, this guy's going to throw harder. And you know, we can talk about adding velocity. And there are teams who have been successful at adding velocity. But there's still, it's still absolutely true that most players will never throw as hard as they did in high school and college as a pro. Most guys lose velocity. And so it's hard to just kind of look at this guy. Oh, well, if we just add two ticks of velo to all these guys, they're great. You know, I think that's a real dangerous way to look at things.
I will say, from an outsider's perspective, if you're a Dodger fan or supporter, it's probably more fun to dream on a bunch of guys that throw 98 and then hope that they can hit the broadside of a barn at some point.
Oh, yeah. Their first round pick is this. Absolutely, you know, fascinating guy that, you know, I never heard any first round buzz on heading into the draft. I mean, it's the last pick of the first, but it's, you know, it's Maddox Bruns. And if I told you about, you know, a high school lefty throwing like 98 with this mid 80s slider, like the absolute bastard movement, like two plane, huge down, huge lateral, like you'd think this dude was a top 10 pick, but like there are days where you'd show up and, you know, he wouldn't get out of the second inning because he'd walk five in a row. And so you take this guy, if you get strikes out of this guy, it's the find of the century. But you don't want to bet on it. And they took a ton of dudes like that.
Cool. I really like the term bastard movement. I think that's something I'm going to hold on to and use.
There are professional reports in Major League Baseball databases that I've written that have the word bastard slider in it. So I've made my mark.
there's some great terms in the scouting glossary. Maybe that's something I'd like to add. What are your favorite scouting terms? Because there once or twice something will pop for me every year where I'm like, I can't believe that's something that people actually use. And then, yeah, I'd like to learn and incorporate it in my writing.
Oh, God, it's a family show, right? Bastard Slayer is always a good one. I'm trying to think of what else I got to use them. I'm trying to think if the Jays took anyone like this, but I don't think they did. Like for a big dude, I would always put extra large human, which I always enjoyed talking about. Like I know, for a great example, I know, because I went and I saw him as an amateur. Like when I think the way I wrote scouting reports, the first part was like a physical description, then for a pitcher kind of delivery description, then getting to the command. And I know like the first sentence I read about Alex Manoah was extra large human, you know, and that's a great example, you know, and so that was always a good one. But you learn a lot. Like every scout uses different stuff. And I think you should have fun when you write scouting reports, and not enough guys do.
Yeah, for sure. Extra large humor is good. I know that at one point I wrote something about Bartolo Colon, and I used the term generously proportioned, which I felt was...
That's nice, yeah.
A nice euphemism.
Yeah, I would use the word beefy, you know.
That's a little less nice, arguably.
Yeah, beefy, I think I was like, was definitely a word I used a lot.
Before we let you go, I just wanted to ask a little bit about how this draft... process has been different, you know, just it seems like it's ever shifting, right? Even the number of rounds is changing on a year-to-year basis. We know a lot of that had to do with COVID, the way things are being evaluated. Do you think that kind of when it's all said and done and the dust will settle, this will look like a weird draft in terms of who went where because the evaluation was kind of, yeah, it was a little bit different and thrown off a bit by the circumstances in the world?
Yeah, I think it's a weird draft, but I do, it might be kind of the new normal in some ways. You know, this is, we don't know what the draft's going to look like next year just because we have a CBA upcoming, and the draft gets worked out there. It's always the last thing they work out. It's kind of like the stepchild in the corner you talk about after you figure everything else out. But I don't think we're ever going to see 40 rounds again. I think 20 or 25 rounds is going to be the new normal. But the draft always kind of changes and evolves. I don't think you'll see the pitching heavy draft next year that you see this year just because we'll have, you know, they'll be more comfortable with full years of data off of guys. But it's something that's always, you know, evolving and changing. But this was a weird draft, you know, and I've talked to teams post draft and they all say it was weird, and that word gets used a lot. And, you know, you said I could curse. So like I got a text on Sunday night when it was over from a scouting director. And she said, what the fuck just happened? You know, and it was like teams were like trying to figure out, you know, what happened. And there were lots of strange first round picks, and you go, what are they doing? And then, you know, lots of teams did that and they saved money and then they spent more lower below. There was a lot of kind of cost savings and kind of redistribution of bonus pools, and it was interesting to see how big of a trend that becomes. But yeah, it was a weird draft, and it's hard to say whether it means something. I mean, again, just like the players themselves, ask me in 5 years and we'll see if this is the beginning of something or just a weird outlier.
All right, Kevin, we appreciate you coming on. We know that you may be, you know, sleep deprived over the last few days, tons of work put in. And
sleep deprived all year, man.
Fair enough. Yeah, I feel you there. But but I know though you'd like to get some rest now, and hopefully you can go do that.
I'll try. I've actually, yeah, I'm starting. I have another podcast to record in 90 minutes. So
that's a good nap.
Exactly. Naps are underrated.
All right. Thanks again, Kevin.
Accurate. Yeah, no thanks, problem, man. Guys. Have a good one.
You too.
A great insight from Kevin. I wish I could have gone deeper into his scouting glossary. I like words. I always like to have more ammunition to play with. But, you know, that bastard slider is something that I'll definitely be thinking about going forward. I don't know if anyone on the Blue Jays quite has the bastard slider.
Manoah might.
When it's really going, sometimes it gets a little loopy. Okay, so sure. Just before we get out of here, let's just tee up that weekend series. After too long without Blue Jays, we've got Blue Jays Rangers, a rivalry that used to exist that it became meaningless in pretty short order.
Yeah, both those teams really didn't go very well for them after 2016.
So that was a thing until, well, I don't know, let's say that both teams were good again and they met in the playoffs again, I'm sure we'd see a lot of montages and people would dredge up old feelings. But realistically, we're gonna need another bump on it. What we got wasn't enough. But so I guess what you're gonna enjoy about watching the Jays face the Rangers is that the Rangers are not a good team, which is going to increase the Blue Jays' chance of success. What they do have is a couple of those trade bait options. Like I said before, I don't know if the Blue Jays are fishing in waters like these, but there's been a lot of people fantasizing about Joey Gallo and Kyle Gibson. Yeah.
Ian Kennedy, maybe?
Ian Kennedy I could see happening. Yeah. Gallo and Gibson... Gallo, I mean, in some ways, awesome, great athlete, big left-handed power, very productive this year. Also, you know, very inconsistent. Like, this would be a huge buy high on Gallo because he's had some good years and he's been pretty useless at times as well. You'd have to pay a lot to get Gallo. Gibson is interesting because he's someone who sort of remade himself as a pitcher. That can happen later in careers in a way that I find more believable. You know, the Blue Jays wanted Gibson all along. I don't think they even imagined he would become something like this. If they added him, I mean, that, you know, that's a huge rotation addition for them to make. That's another big package. If it's going to be one of those guys, I think I'd be more inclined to see them go after Gibson. But yeah, I mean, again, watch those guys and do all the fantasizing you want, but don't don't invest too much emotional capital in that, because I don't think
that's probably fair.
I don't think that's coming around.
I mean, just you're right about Gallo being inconsistent and whatever, and I, you know, he doesn't really play third base anymore, which had he still be, you know, had that still been, you know, his main position.
Yeah, I mean, he's still young and athletic. Like, he could do it. Like, it's not like he's aged out of that.
But I don't think that's a defensive upgrade necessarily at third base. Like, because that's sort of that for me is the perfect fit, right? If you have a good defensive third baseman who also hits like Joey Gallo and also is, you know, consistent, like a lefty with real power, that would be fantastic. But I, you know, trying to fit him into the outfield mix makes it a bit more difficult. And I think they kind of got the guy. They got their Joey Gallo and Corey Dickerson probably, which is going to be interesting. He should be back soon enough, which I think will help and give, you know, just give the lineup a different look and lengthen it and be a good thing for them if, you know, he's your lefty hitter who you know, who hits right-handed pitching, I guess. But yeah, I you know, the Gallo fantasizing I totally get. Gibson, you're right, I think is probably. Probably makes more sense, but yeah, the package will be quite large to get any of these sort of guys, and I don't, you know, I feel that the Jays are more in the mode of, I don't base this on anything that they've said, like they don't talk about these things, but it seems more likely to me that, you know, guys who are going to have to be added to the 40-man this winter, where there's already a log jam on the 40-man, guys like Kevin Smith are probably their bigger trade chips than, you know, the kind of guys that you can really go and use to get, you know, superstar kind of packages. Like, I don't see them trading Groshans. I don't see them trading Austin Martin, Nate Pearson, any of the top guys. I think Smith is probably like the ceiling. But again, that's just a guess, and it depends who becomes available, I suppose. But also, I think in this, you know, the way that teams value young players and years of control, you get a lot out of a Kevin Smith or a lot out of an Alejandro Kirk if that's, you know, the kind of guy you're training.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested what, like, both of those guys, Gallo and Gibson, are interesting because they've been so much better this year than they've traditionally been. You know, Gallo has spiked in the past, but this is his best year. And Gibson has been just so bored. Like, even when I hear his name, I just think, like, oh, fourth starter for a decade. You know what I mean? Like, he's just with the Twins forever, and he was fine. Like, when the Blue Jays were pursuing him, I was like, oh, okay, that's a boring-ass guy to go after, but sure, why not? And when they, I have no proof of this, but, like, I called that they were going to sign Tanner Roark based on nothing ages when they, like, months before they did it. Because it was like, yeah, they're just going to go get some boring-ass guy. And Roark and Gibson were kind of the same guy at that point. But he's become really exciting. So maybe that brings the price a little bit down because they have, especially Gibson, less of a track record. Again, it's just probably not worth investing too much thought or emotion into because I just don't see them shopping at that tier. Kennedy is an interesting guy to watch. The last guy to keep an eye on, and this is not a Blue Jays trade target, I just think that Adolis Garcia is so fun right now as a guy to, and they're like,
sure,
a guy's broken through, way older than traditional rookie because he was with the Cardinals AAA affiliate for ages, could never quite find it. He's sort of got that Teoscar Hernandez thing going where he's got the big power and the big speed. and the questionable Troche. And those guys are always super fun to watch. Like my favorite yeah. player when I first started watching the Blue Jays, and it was a very weird window to first start watching the Blue Jays, but it was Raul Mondesi.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and Sean Green was so much better, and they never should have gotten Mondesi, and like all that stuff is true. But I loved Raul Mondesi because he just, you know, he ran like the wind. He stole bases at, you know, more than he should have at that point of his career. He had the big, he had big time power. He swung for everything. Like, I always enjoy that aesthetic, maybe less so on a team if I have a rooting interest these days. and as I've come to learn a little bit more about the game, but I always find those guys fun to watch. And he's like one of those guys who swings for fences and runs like hell and is a good story too. So if you have a moment, maybe if the Blue Jays are in the middle of a blowout win, to take your eyes off of them and appreciate what's going on in Texas, he's a guy to cast an eye over to.
Into it, for sure.
All right.
Raul Mondesi, wow.
Yeah, it takes starting your fandom at a very specific window to get into Raul Mondesi. Because 1 year later, he was, I think we're basically talking about the year 2000. I think one year later, he was pretty bad. And before it was Sean Green, who was much better. But there you go. I started watching the Blue Jays in the year 2000. I've outed myself as my specific year. Yeah,
you're making me feel very old. I'm like, I liked Willie Upshaw.
I came to it, to be fair, it wasn't the first thing I started watching was hockey, so I came to baseball after hockey. Anyway, we'll leave it there. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Continue to subscribe and leave us ratings and do all the good stuff that you do, and we will be with you next week.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.